written and posted a number of articles on various websites about 9/11, Mars, chemtrails, and anti-gravity research, whilst also challenging some of the authorities to address some of the most compelling data that is available. And today, we're going to start off, I guess, by talking about the alternative theory to controlled demolition 9/11. The website is Check the Evidence. And welcome to the show, Andrew.
Thank you very much, James, for that introduction and for inviting me to come on and chat with you all.
Again, I really appreciate staying up late. It's you know, there are time frame problems with talking around the world, but it's so important that you know, we share this information through internet writing and whatnot, because the mainstream obviously is not doing their job. And so, again, I appreciate you stopping by.
Yeah, well, same here. Thanks for, you know, doing what you do as well.
So after being to your website, Check the Evidence, which is a lot of neat stuff on it, what I was originally turned on to you by a listener was about your information about 9/11. And as I mentioned to you, we had Dr. Judy Wood on, who was talking about the non-demolishing space weapon of some type and so on. She gave her presentation. I thought one of the most interesting things I learned from it was not actually what she was saying, but what she said and others didn't say. I found it very interesting that the people who support the mainstream theory neglect a lot of the evidence that's put out by 9/11 Truth Movement, but also a lot of the 9/11 Truth Movement neglect to put out the controlled demolition, neglected to mention evidence like these, all these burnt-up cars that were all over the place, which people were walking down those streets, too. How could some people be affected, others not? And I'll note that they're... just the top sides were done, not the bottom sides. Right, a lot of interesting stuff like that. So it's pretty good. So why don't we start out? I'm sure you have a way of presenting this information that might be comfortable with you. Why don't we kind of just start and go through what you thought compelling in this theory?
Yeah, well, this goes back quite a long way for me in terms of my involvement with 9/11 research, and I kind of somehow seemed to get involved much more deeply than I ever expected to, in terms of some of the, you know, to use the phrase, movers and shakers in, you know, 9/11 sort of research. I'd just like to mention one quick sort of correction. Dr. Wood doesn't talk about a space weapon. There's been a lot of confusion about that particular phrase and the way it's applied and used to the research. There was one point in 2006 where Dr. Judy did mentioned that there might be, you know, something that was coming from above the World Trade Center, and that's one of the bits of evidence that we can perhaps just mention, you know, as we're coming to it now, and that's the circular holes in the tops of World Trade Center, I think World Trade Center 6 and World Trade Center 5. I certainly don't know the numbers of all the buildings and the exact damage to them in the way that Dr. Wood does. She spent more time than anybody else actually studying this in detail. I think for that reason and for that alone, I think people should listen very, very carefully to what she has to say. And again, you know, we've had a huge problem in that a lot of this research is misquoted, partly or wholly misunderstood, and then on that basis it's essentially ridiculed without actually people focusing on some of the things that you brought up, you know, with the cars being upside down, for example. That's one thing that I only became aware of, I think, in late 2006, early 2007, something like that. And you've got this curious situation where you have two cars next to each other, and one is upside down, the other isn't.
I've never heard that ever, and I've had guests on the show talking about 9/11 for years. Until then, I was like, why does someone mention this? It's pretty significant, I thought.
That's right, and I think, you know, there's several reasons for that. I think one of the main reasons is that you give people a certain set of evidence, and they tend to draw a certain set of conclusions. And if you're off and running, you know, with a theory that seems to be valid, then a lot of people will climb on board with that and try and back you up, particularly if you're being critical of the government or, you know, the powers that be, or, you know, the New World Order, or whatever sort of label you put on the enemy, if you want to call it that. And this too, I think, is a way that you can manipulate people's thinking in that you can just say, well, look, I'm going to tell you the truth about 9/11. I know the government's lying. And then you automatically assume, therefore, that that person is telling the truth. And they're not going to be just as dishonest as the people who, you know, were on the 9/11 Commission, for example. But in my experience, we've got people in the 9/11 Truth Movement who are claiming to be some kind of, you know, leaders. They're just as dishonest as the people in the 9/11 Commission were, you know, in actually addressing the evidence. I don't know about the rest of their lives, obviously, but in the way that they address and talk about the evidence, they're just,
for example, by leaving out the cars, for example.
Or for leaving out the discussion of the hurricane, you know, which was parked off the coast of New York, closest to New York City, at 8 o'clock in the morning. You know, and people try and gloss over that, but when you actually look at the path of that hurricane, it's immediately suspicious. So, of course, but the problem then is that when you start to bring up things like that, they're just totally off the radar screen for most people. You know, they don't really know how to deal with that evidence and how to talk about it, particularly if they've never investigated, you know, the history of weather control and weather modification. Technology and research, you know, such as Wilhelm Reich, what he was doing in the 60s, you know, and how that was all shut down, and he was ended up dead, and you know, so you know, one of the things with my website, what I've tried to do is at least take a passing look at all those types of things as much as I've got time, you know, to do, and then try and see where these common threads, you know, lead us, and. I think you can say that you know, certainly the technology that was used on 9/11 does have a history, and I think you can find the evidence for that history is fairly clear. And again, what I've tried to do is sort of, you know, complementary in one sense to what Dr. Judy has done. You know, as you know from having her on your program, you know, a few months back, she looks at the physical evidence. She's done what I would like to call a forensic investigation into the destruction of the World Trade Center, and it really is a forensic investigation into the destruction of the World Trade Center. In that regard, she is the most highly qualified expert, you know, to look at that sort of evidence. She is a specialist in material science. And the other interesting thing, you know, you begin to wonder with these things, you know, life sometimes seems to prepare you for certain aspects, you know, of what you end up doing. And one of Dr. Judy's areas of expertise is what's called interferometry. And her, you know, focus on that was the use of optical methods for measuring stress in materials. And what you basically do to do that is you get a laser beam, and then you split the laser beam through some type of diffraction grating, which is where the beam breaks up into two or more separate beams, and then you divert these beams using mirrors or prisms down separate paths. And then if you arrange things in a certain way with an optical bench, you can actually get these beams to destructively and constructively interfere. Because the length of the beams travel is only one wavelength apart, one wavelength of light, or a multiple of several wavelengths of light. So, you know, this was how she ended up identifying these interference effects in the evidence from the World Trade Center. Now, you know, because I've done a little bit of physics in my degree, and I, you know, it was one of my favourite subjects at school. You know, I know that that sort of talk is valid. I know that she's an expert in interferometry. I've seen the Moiré interferometry patterns that she sent me, which she, you know, kept from some of the research she did. So I know all that's valid and real. So I can 100%, you know, sort of tell you about her credentials being valid. But then, of course, people who are listening to me will think, well, is this Andrew Johnson valid? You know, maybe he's just making this up to sound credible. You know, I don't know. I don't understand what interferometry is. And this is the way it works. And what I mean is, it's actually fairly easy for somebody like, let's say, Stephen E. Jones to say, you know, I'm a professor of physics, and so I know what happened at the World Trade Center. and people will believe him. You know, I mean, I believed him for well over 12 months. I thought he was being truthful in his discussion and analysis of what happened on 9/11, and I actually helped him with some video clips and some editing that he asked you know, of people to do for him, and I was involved with his group at the time, and I volunteered to do it, and that's essentially how I became involved with Dr. Judy Wood and to a lesser extent Professor Morgan Reynolds in their what became their legal action against NIST contractors for fraud, and so I got something of an inside view of what was going on within these groups. And it was during that time that I found out that Steve Nee Jones had connections into Cold Fusion. And he was actually the person who published a paper on what he called, or what is called, muon-catalyzed Cold Fusion. And he did that the day before the chemists, the world-class chemists Pons and Fleischmann, published their research, or they didn't really publish it, they had to put it into a press conference, in 1989. And that was the start of the Cold Fusion furor, which, you know, was horrendous to look at. And then you have people like Dr. Eugene Malove, who found out that Massachusetts Institute of Technology, they investigated Cold Fusion, they did some experiments, and they got a positive result. But they masked this positive result by massaging their figures for the excess heat. In other words, the big thing was Cold Fusion, which Pons and Fleischmann were claiming, and for which they were, you know, reviled, basically, was that they were getting out more energy from their experiment than they were putting in. In other words, they might put in, say, you know, 100 watts of power, and they would get out, 200 watts of power, and this, of course, broke the laws of physics. So everyone said, well, you can't have that, you must have made a mistake. And so it was easy to get people to climb on that bandwagon, and one of those people was Steve Nee Jones. He didn't say Cold Fusion wasn't real, but he basically said, you know, you'll never get any usable energy out of it. And Dr. Eugene Malove, he wrote a book in 1991. It was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and it was called Fire from Ice. It's out of print now. But I think you can still get hold of it on, you know, second-hand copies on Amazon and these other sellers. And he mentions Steve Nee Jones on 100 pages in his book about how Steve Nee Jones seemed to be trying to sort of do various things within the Cold Fusion debate, which weren't altogether, you know, savoury, shall we say. And so when I found this out in relation to 9/11, I realized that Steve Nee Jones had a history. I realized that he worked for Los Alamos National Laboratories. I realized that he made very dubious, probably even false statements, such as if you take aluminium and you heat it up, it will be silvery at all temperatures in daylight conditions. And this is, we've actually got an audio clip of him saying this. This is not true. If you heat aluminium up sufficiently, it will glow orange. And then you start to argue with people over this point, for example, when you're discussing about 9/11 and the various sort of tactics that are used by certain researchers. And, you know, you get wrapped up in this silly argument, which takes you away from discussing the actual overall effects that were seen at the World Trade Center, which are completely inexplicable, except, you know, by looking at some type of technology which we've not actually seen used in the public domain before. So, you know, that's sort of bringing in a few things together at threads that perhaps people are not familiar with. I've talked about these on other, you know, radio broadcasts that I've done. I don't know whether where you want to go from there.
Yeah, well, can I ask? So, I mean, the thrust of this is that He was saying that Cold Fusion was not, would not be usable. That, yeah, you can get maybe over unity, but it's not actually feasible, usable. So he was kind of throwing cold water on the Cold Fusion, so to speak.
Yeah. Yeah, and my understanding is that it was actually Steve Nee Jones himself who coined the phrase Cold Fusion. I believe there's documentation which supports that. And this we also seem to see the same sort of thing, because Steve Nee Jones was the same guy who started calling what Judy Wood had been researching space beams. No, that's not what she called it. She called it a directed energy weapon.
Right.
And people then sort of took this, because Dr. Wood mentioned that possibly some of the research might have been done as part of, you know, the SDI program, Strategic Defense Initiative, and of course the pet name for that was the Star Wars program.
Right.
That's what all the press called it. So you got this connection between, you know, SDI, or the Star Wars program is what it was commonly termed, because, you know, that had obviously took in a lot of money, billions went into that program, and possibly some of this technology, which was energy weaponry, and that's what they were looking at. They were looking at, you know, high energy lasers and that sort of thing. But at the time that this was posted on Dr. Wood's website, she was literally just saying, well, it might possibly have been something like that. You know, I don't actually, you know, I'm not actually 100% sure that was it. It just might have been that. But as she, you know, went on and gathered more of the evidence, she found that that didn't fully explain things. One of the reasons being is the aspect that, again, is commonly misquoted, and this is the aspect of heat, and this is one of the things that I always like to talk about.
Let me go back 1 second to Stephen Jones.
Mm.
So, I mean, is it possible, I'm getting from what you're saying is that he mm-hmm. would be, you are saying that he might have a history of trying to derail a particular train of thought, as opposed to simply just being one of the many physics guys out there who disagree with a particular theory. I mean, a lot of people
Correct.
Don't think cold fusion is worth its salt. I mean, that's probably the main flow of things. But it seems to be more of a planned derailment of certain trains of thought, is what you're...
I would say categorically... in the case of Stephen E. Jones, I'm happy to say that he has a job to do. He is out to herd people intellectually. He was successful with me. He herded me intellectually into his little pen of thermite and conventional technologies. You know, he was even introduced on the Alex Jones program some years ago. I believe I've got this clip somewhere on my website. Alex Jones proudly announced that Stephen E. Jones had headed up investigations for the US government, and he'd worked for Los Alamos National Laboratories at a time. I don't think he works there full time. And of course, Los Alamos is where they developed the A-bomb. So, is this a good pedigree, we ask ourselves? Well, you know, each person has to make their own mind up on that type of issue. But the fact that he has a history in being involved with Pons and Fleischmann, and so he knows about energy technologies, and then Dr. Wood's talking about energy technologies being used in relation to 9/11. And then you find out, for example, that Eugene Malov was murdered in 2004 under suspicious circumstances. And Dr. Eugene Malov was working with another chap called William Zabur, Bill Zabur. And they eventually formed this, I forget the name of it, it's the New Energy Foundation, or I think that's what it was called, or the Infinite Energy Foundation. I get the two names mixed up. I think they founded the New Energy Foundation, and then they had a magazine called the Infinite Energy Magazine or something. And Bill Zabur and Eugene Malov were the prime movers in this, and Bill Zabur had a nephew, and that nephew was Michael Zabur. And he was Dr. Judy Wood's student, and Michael Zabur was murdered in April 2006, I think it was, just after he and Dr. Wood had posted a short paper or of a demonstration, which was all revolving around this molten aluminium thing, which I mentioned earlier on.
All right, well, hold on, we'll take a short break and come back. You have to excuse me, I have these coughing fits here. I'm getting over a cold, so in case I don't hit the cough button, I don't need to cough in your ear, but hold on, we'll be back to continue. This is going to be, I think, an interesting show as we go through all these points. And remember, when we talk about things, keep your mind open. You know, so let this information come in, sit around, kind of kick around and see what happens. But anyway, hold on, we'll be back right after this. Well, I was on the on break. Andrew, I did get a phone call. Let me take this real quick. You want to ask a question about something you just said?
Sure.
All right, caller, are you there?
Hello?
Try it again. There we go. How are you? Are you there now?
Yeah, you there?
Yeah, can you hear me?
Yeah, just barely, but that's normal when you talk to a talk show host.
Okay. I recognize this guy.
I don't know if you or Andrew got to see the email I put out today, but there's a I found a picture of a circularized burn pattern indicative of directed energy weapon usage on the helicopter landing deck of the Blackwater Horizon oil rig. And I'm wondering if you got to see that, Andrew, yet.
Yes, Sheldon, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me?
Oh, yes. Tell you what, why don't you just hang up and listen to his answer then and make it simpler.
Okay.
All right, thanks.
Yep.
I don't know. Some people call in and they hear as clear as a bell, and other people can't. I just kind of gave up at this point.
Okay.
Let me go ahead.
Yeah, this is Sheldon. He's in Tucson. I know, I communicated with Sheldon quite.
His name is Ted on the break. I don't know if I don't
okay.
know. Okay, but go ahead.
It sounds very. It must be him because
okay,
he just sent me an email just before I came on. Yeah, what he's referring to is obviously this horrible Gulf disaster and the platform that blew up and sank or whatever happened to it. I've just seen this picture literally probably about half an hour ago or an hour ago or so. That he sent with this circular hole in the platform, or I don't even know if it's circular actually, because I haven't studied the picture very well. So I don't know what the answer to his question is. I don't know whether they used an energy weapon on the platform. I really have no idea because, you know, just to really make the point that from what Dr. Wood has done, she's looked at, you know, tens of thousands of pictures to come to her sort of conclusions about 9/11. I've perhaps looked at a fraction of those, maybe, I don't know, a couple of hundred, maybe 300 tops, something like that. But I've only seen this one picture of the oil platform, and from that, you know, it's difficult to say.
I did address something in the opening, is I got something in email showing a video which had a blue streak going up to this, we'll call it to space or what have you. But oddly enough, if you look at my webcam picture right at the moment, this was a total coincidence, and I love coincidences like this. Mm. There is a blue streak in my webcam picture because there was a very intense light source.
Yeah.
And to me, when I saw the video, it just was clearly, without second thought, it was clearly a lens effect.
Yeah.
So, I mean, yeah. I can't, I mean, maybe it isn't, but to me, it was a done deal, and, you know.
I tend to agree, and I think, you know, this highlights sort of a problem, really, in that, I was saying this to somebody the other day, when you get into this field, it's very easy to sort of just immediately assume that you see something which looks odd. You assume that there's going to be some, you know, horrendous explanation for it, which nobody knows and nobody will talk about. You know, you can become quite paranoid. When sometimes the explanation is perfectly normal, perfectly, you know, natural or whatever. Not everything is run by, you know, these secret sort of operations, and not everything is a Masonic symbol or whatever, you know. Well, that's my view anyway. It's worth keeping your mind open, but not so open that your brain falls out, you know, as the saying goes, I think. So I think, you know, getting that balance is important.
Right.
And that's the difficulty. But I think what I was trying to sort of get people to think about was the energy connection, to 9/11. Lots of people are talking about, you know, we know it wasn't Al-Qaeda that did it. We know that, we've got these put options, and we know that there were these insurance companies involved in providing the insurance for the buildings, and we know that Larry Silverstein said this on PBS, and we know that so-and-so said that. And, but, you know, it's easy to actually overlook what actually happened. And again, going back to one of the key points of evidence that Dr. Wood brought to my attention, which really was the starting point for my transformation of understanding, and that's the justification of the spire, as it is called. And I don't mean the spire that was the communications spire on top of one of the buildings, which I can never remember which one it was, this huge 300-foot thing, but there was a sequence in the video of the destruction of I believe, tower number one. And it's got 70 stories of unsupported steel. And you can see this thing actually turning to dust before your very eyes. And we have this, several videos of this. I actually edited together a little 1 or 2 minute video of several of these angles. And you can actually see this steel turning to dust. And this really is the key point of evidence which people refuse to talk about, or quite often will refuse to talk about. Oh, they'll just dismiss it as some kind of, you know, insignificant thing. It's just the tower sort of, you know, falling down as it did. But you can actually see, if you watch carefully, the grid structure of this steel actually turning to dust over a period of about 8, 9, 10 seconds, something like that. And this is after the main sort of...
Where is this picture?
Well, you can see it. There's a CNN news broadcast which has it. It's literally just as the tower has mainly gone down. You know, you see all this huge dust cloud come down, and then within this dust cloud you see this, you know, segment sticking up. And this is on, you know, Dr. Judy's got this.
Okay,
Dr. Judy has got this on her WTC page. If people want to see this, if they go drjudywood.com/WTC, or if you put in WTC Spire, something like that, dust, and into Google, I'm sure you'll get a video of this.
Okay.
And of course, the thing that I say to people is, well, look, just have a look at that video, you know, have a look at it carefully, think about it for, you know, 5 minutes. As far as I can tell, that is 70 columns of unsupported steel that's there. I can't think of anything else that would stand like that for the period of time that it did, unsupported. It must be steel. You could make an argument that it was perhaps, I don't know, some other material, but I think it'd be very tricky to make that argument sensible when you actually think about what you're seeing. So you're left with this video of this 70 columns of steel turning to dust before your very eyes in about, as I say, 8 or 10 seconds. You know, and what can cause that? I mean, you know, what do you know that can cause steel to turn to dust like that?
I'm looking around while you're talking, and I see there's a ABC admits the World Trade Center steel turned to dust. You get a little clip of that in there.
Well, there you go. And you even hear some of the reporters saying that all the buildings turned to dust. Well, how can burning materials like thermite or whatever turn something to dust?
Thermite would turn something into molten, and then it would cool in a globule type thing.
Yeah, exactly. It would go into a globule of material. And yet, even the people who talk about thermite will say in casual conversation, oh yeah, we can see the dust, you know. But that doesn't happen with thermite. Does not happen. So this theory just does not make sense on its face. I mean, I can go into all the other problems, but I've had to make a whole blog about that.
What about, I read somewhere where someone mentioned that what makes thermite up, what is it? Is it aluminum, metal, and sulfur, or something like that? Or steel, or iron, and sulfur?
We've posted a bit on this as well.
Right, I mean, it's not exactly the most rarest elements there are, you know.
Well, you see, this is where the thermite theory just, you know, it's like the official story. You look at it, you know, you're given a story, it looks plausible, and you buy it. The thermite story is really not that much different. You think, oh yeah, the towers came down, well, it can't have been the plane crashes, there must have been explosives. Oh, thermite's an explosive, according to some. It's not. It's an incendiary. Oh, it burns, it was a hot fire, it melted the steel. Sounds plausible. But going back to the formula, thermite is actually made of iron oxide and aluminium powder. And it's, I think, if I remember my chemistry properly, it's actually a classic oxidation-reduction reaction, where one substance gets oxidized, which is the aluminium, and the other gets reduced, which is the iron oxide. And you get this very, very hot reaction, which runs at about 2,000 degrees centigrade or something. I forget the exact temperature. But you see, the thing is that the World Trade Center's exterior was made of an aluminium alloy. And within the World Trade Center were, of course, these 236 steel columns and 47, those are the exterior ones, and 47 interior columns. And after 30 years, that steel does have some rust on it. It will have some rust coating, of course, they're not all rusted through, but there will be a significant amount of iron oxide within those beams. And so when you say, oh, thermitic materials were discovered in the World Trade Center dust, well, yes, of course they were, because there was steel you know, steel beams which had rust on them, and that turned to dust, and the exterior of the World Trade Center, most of that turned to dust as well. So of course there was unreacted thermite. In other words, there was aluminium powder and there was iron oxide in the dust. Of course there was. So it's kind of a sort of clever bit of misinformation, really, because you can hold up a dust sample and you can say this has got active thermitic materials in this dust sample I have in my hand. You know, I can go and test it in a laboratory, and you'll find just what Steve Jones and others say it is. But the thing is, it was already there in the first place in the natural materials, or the set of materials that the World Trade Center was made of anyway. So, you know, there's no way you can really move forward from that. And then again, going back to the other evidence, you can't explain the upside down cars, you can't explain the hurricane, you can't explain the exploding oxygen tanks which were on the back of the fire truck, you can't explain David Hampshire being levitated and carried a block, you can't explain the weird fires where you've got a fireman apparently walking through a fire. How can a fireman walk through a fire? Well, my answer would be because it's not a fire. It's not a fire in the normal sense. It's a fire which is cold, which ties up with the other evidence of a destroyed car which looks like it's been burned, but all the upholstery is intact. How can that happen?
Yeah, that's pretty wild.
Yeah, when you see all these pictures and you study them carefully, and then you find other pictures that Dr. Wood's got, which are really, really interesting, from a couple of the buildings opposite, where you've got double-glazed, glass units within this building, and only one of the panes is broken. How can that happen if it's projectiles coming through? How can it only break one pane?
Well, you know, I'm the subject of this beam. I had John Hudson on my show a couple times, very long. I had a four-hour interview once. And
right.
One of the things he had mentioned was that he thought his beam interrupted kind of a space-time type of a thing. And that's what caused the gelification and destruction. And if you take, say, you put this beam that's able to have some atoms end up moved to a different space and time than others, well, it would completely destroy the intact item. But also, what I thought was interesting was, and I can't remember if it was him or Dr. Wood who mentioned this. excuse me. The classic straw through a tree from a tornado. It is theorized that the straw goes so fast and hits the tree so hard that it passes through the tree without crumbling. Well, I've never really thought about it. That doesn't sound right, but who knows? But then, on talking with one of these people, they mentioned that a vortex of the tornado could actually be physically altering space-time, and at that moment in time, the straw pass through the tree which wasn't there, and then it's there, and that's why it ended up like that without being broken. And this way, how this ties into what you said was certain places of space and time on the World Trade Center, if it was displacing space time like that, you would have something's broken, something's not broken, you would have the powdering, the gelification, the burnt holes, you know, all would be explained.
Well, this is the conclusion that I've come to from looking at the evidence. And I'd become familiar with John Hutchison's work in about 1999, so I'd heard of this, some of these disruptive, effects, at that time. I never made the connection. In fact, I didn't make the connection to 9/11 until, I was talking to Dr. Judy Wood, and she showed me the pictures, and that was in late 2007. And when we spoke to John Hutchison, he spoke with us on Ambrose Lane's radio program in February 2008. And I came over to stay in Washington D.C. with a friend we have over there, and we went to the studio together. And John said he thought that they might have opened up a portal with the technology. Those were the words that he used. And like you say, it's a very interesting sort of way of expressing things. But again, going back to the basic energy question, one of the things I'd like to highlight in that is the lack of heat, because people assume there was a lot of heat in the destruction of the World Trade Center. I've just had another kind of running intellectual battle, if you will, with this Dmitry Karlazov, who's recently posted this 4-hour-long set of videos on YouTube about the 150 kiloton nuclear explosion destroyed the World Trade Center, and he has this big, long, fancy explanation into how this was what did it, and yet, you know, it doesn't explain the evidence, frankly. So, the energy issue is very important. John Hutchison, for example, he can levitate a cannonball in some of his previous experiments, and he can turn metal into jelly using 1,500 watts of power.
Right, and I've seen those videos.
Hold
on for 1 second. We're going to break for a 10-minute This Week in Free Energy. And I will call you back at the top of the hour, and then we'll be here for the last two. I will just give you a ring back. All right, so...
No problem.
All righty, we'll be back. Talk with Andrew and take your phone calls, emails, and all that. So we can talk about this subject because it's very interesting. The only way we're going to find stuff is by talking and sharing, and not by name calling and arguing. But anyway, we'll be back live to continue with Sterling Allen right after this.
Contact James live on the air several different ways. You can call by phone, toll-free in the United States and Canada at 888-863-2722. If you have internet access, point your browser to www.feettofire.com. That's www.feet2fire.com. And check the left of the screen for the How to Participate text and click. You can then choose Direct Chat with James or join the official group chat room. You can send email to James at f2f@innersights.com. That's f2f@innersites.com. There is a video chat room to see James in action, as well as other F2F listeners. www.ivisit.com has the free software to download and access the Feet to Fire video chat room. And now, live from Chicago, here is the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
Those grabbing hands, well, you know, there's a lot of things went down in the Trade Center. They found all kinds of gold in the basement. There was a bankruptcy going on for WorldCom. All those paperwork happened to disappear. A lot of things went on. The owner of the building made several billion. I mean, a lot of hands were grabbing at that time. And we have with us live from England, Andrew Johnson, who's a researcher into many of these types of issues, everything from the moon and Mars to 9/11. And hold on. Reach over, hit the button, and welcome back, Andrew.
Thanks, James. Thanks very much for inviting me.
Maybe we should just start at the next item on the list and going through this. One of the things about this ray, I guess, however you want to call it, weapon, is that people tend to look as like, well, you know, how does that exist? We don't have this technology. You're saying that's some kind of magic ray or whatever. But as we started talking about last hour with Hutchison, his work, that obviously this thing could be very real.
Absolutely, James. Yeah. You see, when I came across this, I already knew quite a bit of John's story because I don't know if you've heard of a character called Colonel John Alexander. Now, he was, maybe still is, the head of the non-lethal weapons program. Which came out with all these various sort of weird and wonderful weapons, I think one of which was the LRAD system, which is this acoustic weapon. I think it's something like a long-range acoustic defense or something, LRAD. And John Alexander was associated with SRI, which is the Stanford Research Institute, which was some type of offshoot from Stanford University, and I believe both the university and that that SRI, Stanford Research Institute, they got quite a lot of contracts from the military. We've got things like Operation Stargate, which is the remote viewing program, associated with SRI, and There was even a CBS report on cold fusion about a year ago, 18 months ago, and the guy that they spoke to on that cold fusion report was a scientist who worked for SRI. I remember this. Remember seeing the guy walking back into the building with the SRI above the door. And Colonel John Alexander, well, I have documents that were sent to me, and John Alexander makes no secret of this. He also was associated with Los Alamos National Laboratories, and he went to see John Hutchison in Canada in 1983 with a team of four or five people, and he was there for a period of about 4 months. So we have a direct link between John Hutchison and somebody who worked at Los Alamos National Laboratories.
Well, he did have a lot of people out at his place in Canada filming every angle possible, taking notes. And so whatever John Hutchison did, the government surely had reams of paper on and miles of film about.
And, you know, and at this point I'd like to just mention, if I may, that if people want to check out that evidence, they can go to www.thehutchisoneffect.com, which is a website I set up on behalf of John, because his previous website was essentially, it's been essentially hijacked. I mean, it's still there, and most of the stuff is on it. But the person who would, was running that website started not passing on the donations that were coming in to John. And the contact was then listed as somebody called Ace Baker, and this happened coincidentally not long after we'd made the connection between the Hutchison effect and 9/11. This all transpired within a period of about 12 months after that. And if people want to read this story and fill in some of the details which I'm talking about in relation to Steve Jones and my involvement with the 9/11 Scholars Group, which is how I ultimately became involved with Dr. Judy Wood, I've actually compiled a whole book about this, and people can download it for free. They can download the electronic version for free from my website. If you just go to checktheevidence.com, click on the banner, you can download the PDF file. It's all free. I also made a free audio book, which is downloadable on the same page, so you can listen to all the text on your iPod or your iPhone or whatever weird and wonderful MP3 player you happen to have handy. That's all free. So I try to do, you know, the best I can to make this information as accessible and as available as people, you know, as I can, that people can get it at no cost. And I also will send them out DVDs, which have got all the background to this as much as I can get, you know, onto a disc. I send those out all over the world when I can, when people ask me to send them. If people haven't got any money, you know, I'm not bothered. I can afford to send them out because I'm still, you know, I still have to earn a living, and the Open University keep giving me work. So, you know, I can sort of fund this from that, fortunately.
Well, actually, speaking of your making a living at your university, has this information you're putting on, has it affected you professionally?
Well, not really, because, you see, the work that I do, it's really doing student assessments, and I'm not sort of in the academic side, and I don't, and the tuition that I do is part time, and I think basically they have a hard time getting people who are willing to do part time tuition. The Open University is a university which does correspondence courses, and it's actually just had its 40th anniversary, so you know. I'm actually a contractor to the Open University for part of, it's a bit of a complicated arrangement to explain it in a short, you know, discussion, but I work as a sort of private contractor, and they can send me work and I can refuse it, if you see what I mean. I get paid on a sort of piecemeal basis. I did actually manage to get an article published, this was almost, in fact it was 3 years ago, in one of the Open University's faculty magazines, an article I wrote about 9/11, and it is, to my knowledge, the only article which has been published in the UK in any mainstream university publication which questions the official story of 9/11. Now, it was a faculty magazine, it wasn't a peer-reviewed journal, But nevertheless, it was, you know, it did have a readership of about 20,000 people. And that article is also on my website. You can go and poke around and find it. And you can find the link to the Open University magazine that it's published in, because that's available online to download as well in the archive. So, and I've actually sort of broached the subject with one or two people that I know, but, you know, it's not something you'd ever see in a publicly, you wouldn't see it in any course materials. You know, you just wouldn't see that at this stage, and I wouldn't expect that. I did write to the old vice-chancellor of the university, and I asked her if she'd be willing to let me do a presentation about 9/11, but she refused at that time. And she gave a sort of fairly good reason, which that I wouldn't have been presenting my own research, which I think was a fair comment from a university person, as it were. So I've been down that route a little bit, but I've tried to keep the two separate because it's just basically worked for me that way so far. You know, a few people within the university I've spoken to, but I've kept it all sort of fairly low key and private, you know. But going back to the energy question, you know, I think it's very important that people should pick up on this. And my conclusion now is that, you know, the energy technology is absolutely real. There is a group of people running the world which knows about this technology. Indeed, they know how it works. They built it. They've designed it. They know the physics behind which it operates. I believe that other people, if you look at the research of people like Wilbert Smith, Thomas Townsend Brown, of course Tesla is the big one, and people like, even if you look at Maxwell's original equations, for example, which were developed at the end of the 19th century, it appears that there was a kind of a physics cover-up which went on early in the 20th century, where two mathematicians who were called Gibbs and Heaviside, they took Maxwell's original equations, which were to do with the behaviour of electromagnetic radiation, which includes light, heat, radio waves, X-rays, and they simplified Maxwell's equations, and they took out some of the terms in them, which I forget the name. There is a name for these terms. I think they're called quaternions or something. I forget the exact name. Because that was rather above the level of physics that I got to. That was kind of the next stage up from where I got to. They seemed to take all these equations and simplify them, which then masked this whole area of what might be called ether physics. And other people have stumbled across bits of it, as I say. So if you follow all these threads, as I've tried to do, and pull at them a little bit, you see that you've got a fairly sort of coherent picture overall. You can see that there's this second tier or third tier of science, which is you know, operating on a black budget. They're operating behind closed doors. They're answerable not to any government people, and perhaps not even to any people that we could name. They're answerable to these people hidden in the shadows who seem to be pulling a lot of strings, you know, whilst we're distracted with all the other goings on that we're distracted with. And I think they've also got a very sophisticated set of psychological operations going, such that when somebody calls into the Alex Jones show and says, why didn't you have Dr. Judy Wood on as a guest, that caller is immediately cut off, and the issue is not discussed at all. And this actually happened last Friday.
That's the thing with this, is you have a... I just actually did, last week I did a little monologue on paradigms. Excuse me. I grew up thinking science was the only thing that we really wanted to find truth, and I was very disillusioned when I found out that science was a paradigm religion, like anything else. And when you get to these things, for example, the 9/11 being a inside job, that's a paradigm. And then there's sub paradigms. Was it taken down by charges? I mean, that's an issue. And then people who believe these paradigm views of what it is, they exclude stuff that doesn't fit and include stuff that does fit, even if there's contradictory evidence. Mm. It's almost like listening to a fundamentalist preaching to convert you. I mean, they're going to pull out what works for them, even if it's not even true, if you want to go back to like the original ancient writings and compare and see how the English translation took liberties, etc., it doesn't matter. What matters is they have a paradigm belief, and they will use whatever it takes to do it. And gosh, what a waste of energy. Because, I mean, the truth is the truth whether you know it or believe it or not. It's, you know, it's beyond belief. It's there for us to find.
Yep. Well, you know, I totally agree with what you're saying. And I think really what's happened to me personally is, you know, in my life I've never really been a big joiner of groups. You know, I've sort of just kept my distance from most sort of groups. It's just never appealed to me somehow. I've never really followed the herd particularly, and I think probably a lot of the people that listen to this program, and maybe it applies to you yourself, you know, you didn't really follow the herd, you didn't do the done thing, you did some things at least for a good part of your life that was rather different, you know, and I think that's like all of us. But when you get into these paradigms, people try to herd you into their thinking sometimes, and you know, like they formed all these 9/11 groups now. You know, as you know, we have the scholars group, you've got pilots for 9/11 truth, you've got scientists for 9/11 truth, you've got lawyers for 9/11 truth, you know, you've got architects and engineers for 9/11 truth, and the point is, in relation to this particular issue, is that there's only a very small number of people have actually taken 9/11 evidence and put it into a court case. And Dr. Judy Wood and Dr. Morgan Reynolds are the only two people that have taken aspects of physical evidence in relation to 9/11 and, you know, put them into a court case and submitted that to a court for, inspection and criticism. I mean, we know what the end result has been, of course, because the same people that know how this weapon was designed and how it works, they control the court system through some mechanism or some machination. They control it. And you can see that if you look at the court rulings. But these other people, like architects and engineers for 9/11 Truth, they claim that they've got 1,000 members or whatever the figure's got up to now, yet they're still calling for somebody else to do the investigation. They're still calling for an independent investigation into 9/11. Well, if they've got 1,000 members who are architects and engineers, haven't they got the skills within that group to compile their own interpretation, you know, of the evidence and submit it to a court? I mean, that certainly hasn't happened yet. They haven't done that. This makes me very suspicious of such groups when, you know, I've certainly spent probably several hundred pounds, in other words, maybe up to $1,000 of my own money, just on funding some of the activities related to the court action. So in other words, I've been involved with doing the investigation into some of the events. It's Dr. Wood that's really driven that the hardest. But I actually did help with some of the documentation process, and I submitted an affidavit. I don't really wish to claim any credit for that as such. I'm just trying to point out that, you know, if you know what the truth is and you're convinced that you have the evidence to support that, then you take it as far as you can, and that's what we try to do. Yet all these other groups that say, oh, it can't have been Hutchison effect, they haven't said, oh, well, it was this technology instead. It was, you're wrong, it was this technology, it wasn't that. Here's our case, we built our case, here's the website, here's the court case, here's the court document. Nobody else has done that. So this makes me very suspicious, because obviously you just blowing smoke if you can just get the maximum number of people to agree with you, but then not actually do anything in terms of putting your money where your mouth is or putting your evidence where your talk is.
Well, what if an individual goal is not to follow this through the court or whatever, but to make a to make a niche for him, or for him or herself. In other words, their goal is not to find truth and prosecute, but to become a leader in a movement, so to speak. The worst thing you can have is your positions prove wrong if you're trying to be a person who's in charge or leader of movement. So you're going to use propagandic techniques. In other words, you're going to push your points, ignore other points, because your goal, which may sound like it's 9/11 truth, the goal is really to become a leader within the 9/11 truth. You know what I'm saying?
I do know what you're saying, and I think what's happening is that you know, that is a factors into this probably fairly significantly in some areas. You know, and the basic sort of issue there is ego. You know, is it somebody's ego who's driving their own particular agenda? And I, you know, this book that I mentioned that I posted on my website, people can get a paper copy if they want to get a paper copy, but it costs, it'll cost about $12-$13 or something. It's, you know, it's on one of these self-publishing sites. But what I go into in that is trying to work out where the boundary is between the ego-driven, you know, I want to be a leader, I want to drive this, just because, you know, they're getting prestige, or they're getting recognition, or they're getting, you know, lauded for doing this, which are the reasons, if you don't get money, you know, for doing it, because, you know, we don't get any money for doing this sort of thing. This sort of area of study is not popular. It's not one that attracts a lot of advertising. It's not one that you get paid highly for.
That's for sure.
Et cetera, et cetera. You know, you do it out of love rather than money, than for money. So I try and go into that. Where are we getting the boundary between the ego and this person actually having a script to follow? In other words, being, you know, given instructions from higher up. And certainly to my own satisfaction, I've proved that, to my own satisfaction, that the Scholars for 9/11 Truth Group was an intellectual herding operation. And I was roped into that because I was one of the, you know, I was one of the independent thinkers, as it were, who was doing, as you say, I was looking for the truth. I didn't really care about making a lot of money. I didn't really care about joining a group as such, but I did, because that seemed to be a good thing to do at the time. And I was essentially, you know, for example, to give you one example with this Jim Fetzer character, he invited me to be on the steering committee of the Scholars Group. And I must really re-emphasize that although I went to university and I did, a degree in computer science and physics, it's just a bachelor's degree. I didn't go on to do a master's. I didn't do a PhD. The teaching that I've done has really been, the same degree standard. It's not above degree standard. And yet I was being invited onto this scholars group to be an academic advisor of some kind. I mean, this didn't really make a lot of sense to me at the time, and it still doesn't. Well, it does now, actually, because I was trying to be seen to be important. Somebody was trying to make me feel important.
Right,
but
right.
I realized.
Give you a position, make you feel important, but be under their thumb. Let me say something about Fetzer. I had him on years ago talking about the Kennedy assassination. And there's two things I didn't like about him when he was talking. I mean, I'm not saying what he was saying was wrong as far as the Kennedy assassination, but when I'm more of a philosophically based person with science knowledge, but I kind of look at things from an off angle. And the problem I had with him is that he asked me, how many minutes do I have in the segments? You know, and I told him. And from the minute we came back and he took, started talking, I swear he didn't breathe up until the commercial break every single time. And when I did get some questions in, if I was questioning his opinions, he seemed indignant. Like, you know, and he answered them almost, trying to shut you up, and a couple callers called in with stuff, and he was, again, kind of indignant. And to me, for my philosophical studies of what I would call propaganda, I mean, that's earmarks of it. I'm there to steamroll over you, to push my opinions, and to make people shut up who may disagree, rather than simply presenting evidence or looking at opinion that would look at evidence that would show, you know, okay, well, this is wrong because blah, blah, blah. Not in a propaganda sense. So I was pretty much turned off, and at that point I said to myself that I'm not going to have mine anymore. And that was all before 9/11 movement started with him.
Yeah. Well, that's very interesting, and you know, I think I'd probably heard him, maybe not on your program, but on a couple of others. But I didn't really pick that up then, and it's only really since then. I mean, you know, getting involved in what I've been involved in has actually taught me a hell of a lot about how these movements are manipulated. And people can read that book, as I say, or as much as they want of it. I've got it posted as a set of articles on the website, and you know, I try to go into detail about, you know, how I began to pick up on those things that you've just described, you know, the sort of talking over you and trying to push you in a certain direction and not listening to your, you know, your set of evidence and maybe going, oh, well, you know, well, Andrew, you know, that sounds quite reasonable, but, you know, and then maybe you've got a point there, Andrew, or maybe, you know, and just having a conversation and a discussion about it and trying to sort of come to some conclusion. He as you say, he wasn't like that. And ironically, when the first bit of advice that I gave him on the when I was on the steering committee, he thought I was ridiculous because I was basically saying that John Hutchison was not a fraud, and Fetzer should take his work seriously. And he said, "No, I don't take it seriously at all." You know, and anyway, people can read that whole story. It's not really, I don't think it's very interesting to talk about it here, but. What I think it illustrates at the end of it is that there is a very sophisticated operation going on to keep the connection between 9/11 and the destruction of the World Trade Center and energy completely covered up and keep it off the radar screen. And as I was saying to my brother a couple of weeks ago when I saw him, I said to him, you know, look, how many people do you know who are talking about the topics that I'm talking about, you know, the way that I'm talking about them? And he said, well, nobody. And I said, well, that proves to me how successful the cover-up has been, you know. And how many people do you know in the 9/11 truth movement who are talking about weather modification, weather control, and steel turning to dust? Virtually none. It's a number very close to zero. So that shows you how successful the cover-up within the 9/11 truth movement has been.
Well, we got to stop and take a break here. So when we come back, I can probably go over some of the problems I have with the controlled demolition, because I've seen all the videos talking about it, and I've had some questions that I guess I thought were minor, but ever since talking with Dr. Woods and now yourself, you know, I thought I'd bring these out. So hold on. And we will continue as we talk to Andrew directly from England, Andrew Johnson, right after this. I almost said Andrew Jackson. Hold on.
And now, live from Chicago, here's the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
We are here live with Andrew Johnson, live from England, to talk about, well, he's got a lot of things on his website called checktheevidence.co.uk that will go into many things, everything from the moon to Mars, but we've been kind of focusing on 9/11 and the theory that there was some type of direct energy weapon that brought the buildings down, as opposed to the theory of controlled demolition. And welcome back, Andrew.
Hi, thanks.
I have to be careful. I don't know if it's a mental retardation or not. I have some kind of a reading issue, and one of the things I have problems with is names. And I'm going to be now have to work for the rest of the show. I have to work hard not to call you Andrew Jackson, because the President of the United States is stuck in my mind now, and that's how it works. Well, so I apologize ahead of time in case I slip.
Well, that's you know, we can have a little sidetrack here, because as you say, my name, sometimes I get called Johnston and Johnstone and things like that, but you know, so I'm quite used to that. And Jackson occasionally, yes, I've had a few people call me Jackson. And but you must have heard about the coincidences between Lincoln and Kennedy assassinations. You've heard all those, right?
Right.
And because I talk to people about those sometimes, but. I also have a little, because my birthday is 2211, you see, so that's exactly a year after Kennedy was assassinated, so there seems to be a little sort of coincidental tie-in there, you know, so.
I wonder if when we all look back after it's all over with, we'll see all the little clues along the way and that we may have missed or picked up. But we were talking about this controlled demolition. I did a lot of, first off, I didn't, and even wasn't even aware of this, the 9/11 being an inside job and any of that for years after the fact. I started doing a show in 2003, and it was we're talking about. And I had a guest who had nothing to do with the 9/11. Ian Lungold was his name. He was talking about 2012, actually, the calendar and all this. you mentioned off the air to me about this, and I was just outraged by this. I said, wait a minute, this is true, there would be revolution in the streets. He goes, well, check the evidence. We talked about it for a while, and then I started looking into it, and I ended up having guests on it. What's his name? That's what an
Jim H. Moss. Jim Moss?
Oh, Jim with an H. His last name was H. He's the first guy I had on about 9/11. And it was like, okay, you know. But when I started looking into it and seeing the models for the demolition, there were two things that were missing. Whenever they showed the models of the buildings being demolished, there were huge, loud explosions all over the place. I mean, just loud and cracking like crazy. And the little squibs that came out were a lot of squibs. In fact, most cases, the buildings were, a lot of windows were out, which may explain why it was a little louder and why there were more obvious squibs. But when I looked at the 9/11 collapse, there wasn't any explosions like that. There may have been a couple that happened. There wasn't any explosions, and the squibs that came out were very small in number. And I thought to myself, well, you know, that could be just air escaping from the collapse itself. It puffed out of there. You know, there wasn't a lot like the buildings. I don't know. Is that are those valid as you look at it?
Well, I think, yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, my path was somewhat similar to yours, but I was kind of, I bought into the explosives pretty easily because I didn't see how else the building could have been destroyed. But yeah, when you actually study it in more depth, you're absolutely right. The squibs are few and far between. They're not really particularly energetic. You know, they look more like stuff squirting out. If you look carefully, again, at the videos for those that people already looked at these, the stuff seems to be squirting out rather than exploding out. You know, there's a difference there.
Yeah.
And absolutely, the explosions issue is one that, because what happened with films like Loose Change, you know, and I gave out many copies of Loose Change film, they clipped together all these news segments, you know, of people saying, oh, I've just come out of the building, there was this huge explosion. And this sort of thing. But when you actually look at it again, they're describing explosions before the towers were destroyed, not in the sense of a controlled demolition sequence of explosions. And then going back to the energy weapon evidence, if we look at John Hutchison and his jellification of metals, you know, if you imagine that metal he's jellifying is the wall of a fire extinguisher, what's going to happen? It's going to go bang. You know, and again with the oxygen tank. So, you know, I certainly feel that the people that were in the towers and heard explosive sounds weren't lying. They were hearing was pressurized tanks exploding. You know, so we can explain that from another. You know, in other words, everything that explodes is not a bomb. You know, even if it makes an explosive sound.
Right.
Now, yeah, well, absolutely.
One of the good things about, say, when they talk about the explosions in the bottom is that it really decimates the whole plane idea. I mean, one of the good things about like those videos that are out is that it shows a lot more than the planes couldn't have done it. And so, like, I put out a pest statement years ago calling for a reinvestigation, but I didn't say it was controlled demolition. I didn't say it was. I said it was clear to me beyond all doubt that what has been told to us is not true or inaccurate or incorrect. I don't know how would you say it?
Mm-hmm.
And we should have an independent investigation because there are some issues, and because people aren't telling at all, they're kind of putting a face forward. That doesn't help finding truth. I mean, for example, I'm going to have a guy on. He's going to come up with and explain why it wasn't a controlled demolition and go along with the main story. And I said, well, great. I can't find anybody to come on and talk about it. So I would love to have someone else. Well, he's teaching. He wants this. Actually, probably should be hearing from him soon to come on. I would love to have these other opinions on it because in my way of finding truth, the theme of the show is a lack of contradiction. And when you have a contradiction, it's actually a good thing. It's a sign that says some of your premises are off because we're getting a contradiction here. Mm-hmm. Start to relook at your premises. You know, so when I hear some of the stuff from the people who say it wasn't controlled, I don't mean this. I mean, the standard model, standard whatever they call it. They said, well, yeah, look how bad that Building 7 was damaged. And they showed a picture that I've never seen before. One of the sides of the building had a big gash in it. Now, I still don't think it could have fell down because of that gash, but people were saying, look how good the building was. And they're showing the best side of the building. Meanwhile, on the other side, there was a pretty decent gash in it. See, that's not being fair, you know. And then when we're talking about the controlled demolition versus the energy weapon, you know, those cars were totally left out. I've never saw them in years of having guests on. So when I when I saw those cars from here, I'm like, I've never seen this before. See, that stuff, that problem is when somebody comes in from outside the whole talk, they're believing the standard model given by the government. They come into the 9/11 group and start to look, and they see these things, and they go, wait a minute. You know, it's hurting the whole point to look for truth by having this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I totally agree, you know, James. I mean, I don't, you know, as you know, I mean, things should be, you know, decided on the evidence, not on somebody's opinion. I mean, obviously you come to an opinion about things through studying the evidence, but you don't just skip the evidence part and go with the opinion only. You know, somebody's giving you a conclusion, they have to be able to justify it. And you keep checking that justification as you go along. I mean, you know, as I had to do. And you know, I was fooled by the official story of 9/11. Like, I think you know, similar to what you described, I didn't really question it until about 2003, 2004, I think it was, when I really came across something on the web which made me think, hang on a minute, you know, I've got to go and look at this. And then probably for another couple of years, I was into the buildings being bombed and this type of thing. And then I came across this, you know, this aspect of the planes not actually being involved at the World Trade Center, and I thought, well, that's just ridiculous. Now we got saw all those videos and everything, and it must, what are people on about? It's silly. But then as I studied it, and I came across some simple basic facts, such as, you know, the fact that steel is harder than aluminium, and you look at the damage on the World Trade Center's face, and you see that steel girders have apparently been cut by quarter-inch aluminium wind struts, and this is just not possible. It's simply not possible. And that fact alone contradicts, you know, much of what a lot of the other people were saying, and it's the fact that I've basically, you know, pulled out of the bag when they try and argue this. And
well, let's go to that. So are you saying that there wasn't planes? Or there was planes, but they didn't do the they couldn't take the building down?
Well, what I tell people is, if you go and read the witness accounts, some people said they saw planes hitting the World Trade Center. I'm talking about the first responder accounts.
Right.
And some people said they didn't see a plane. And I did a study about this deliberately for the reason of literally, you know, studying the evidence and trying to find the truth. But if you look at the basic physics of the situation, you know, you take a couple of the pictures from the NIST report, and you see the face of the World Trade Center, you know, one or two, it doesn't matter, and you see these plane-shaped gashes in them, and if you look carefully and just look at the edge of where the wing should have hit, you see that this there's this hole there, and it's as if the wing strut has cut through the steel. And that's not possible. Because if you had wing struts cutting through steel, you would never have needed to develop armor-piercing bullets. You would not need such a thing. So there's something not right with that.
Well, there was a... You may have more... I'm assuming you have more of the physics end of this. The way I would look at it is that you have... sure, it's aluminum, but it's traveling at 600 miles an hour, allegedly, and it's got a lot of fuel in there, so there's a lot of momentum...
That's what a lot of people say to me, and that I've, you know, spent pages of forums with people coming out with that sort of thing, variations on that theme. But let's just take another version of that.
Okay.
You know, we take the official speed of the aircraft, and I think it was between 500 and 540 miles an hour that the aircraft was supposed to have struck the building at. But you're going to ask Boeing whether a plane of that type can travel at 540 miles an hour at 700 feet above sea level, and they will say, well, it's pretty unlikely, because as you know, planes are designed to fly at, you know, 30, 40,000 feet, where the air is thinner. So the plane can't even fly at that speed at 700 feet, and if it did, it would be very, very difficult to fly accurately, and it would
always got, see, But then I figured the black box being taken over by the individuals would explain the accuracy, because a computer could fly the plane.
But there were no black boxes. In fact, if you go and look at the stories about the black boxes, they're contradictory. Some people say there was, I think, two or three found at the World Trade Center, but initially we were told they weren't recovered.
What I meant was, though, they were boxed, there was installed into planes, not publicly released, but they did it by, they put remote control units in the plane.
Oh, I see. But again, you haven't really got any evidence that's publicly available, which you can, you know, like I tell you, there was upside down cars, James, and I can give you five pictures,
right,
you know, which can be traced. If you were to say to me, or Alex Jones was to say, oh yeah, there were remote control boxes fitted to these planes, you know, well, let's look at the evidence for that. Let's see the documents. Let's see that they were.
The documents are pretty hard to find, because they're saying. People are saying that they don't want to tell people these things are in there.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
That's kind of convenient.
That's it. And you get all these anonymous whistleblowers coming forwards and saying all these things that, you know, they can't give the full details because they'd lose their job or their family would be killed or this sort of thing. And, you know, maybe that's true in some case, you know, I don't know. But you get into all these sorts of arguments and you get gradually get drawn away from the evidence. That's what you have to stick to. And going back to the planes crashing, you know, you look at the videos and the plane seems to melt into the building. And of course, if you think about this and you look at other plane crash videos, you can see, I've seen a plane coming into land and it's coming in too fast. It lands on a runway. It's a reasonable sized jet. It's not a 767. It comes really heavy landing. It bounces, but it's such a heavy landing that the tail breaks off. Because these are made of light materials. They have to be made of light materials to fly. So when this plane comes whistling into the World Trade Center, and again, if you look at the videos, some of them show the plane coming on a dive bomber path. Some show it turning at a slight angle and coming into the tower. The moment that you get that sort of translation of movement on the impact of the tower, and this is basic physics, you know, you think of an Indy car crashing into the side of the track, and it will mash up, but it will also spin round. In other words, the forward motion of the car is turned into rotational movement because of it hitting the barrier at an angle. The same would have happened at the World Trade Center. The plane would have come in at a slight angle, and it would have slewed round, the tail would have broken off and fallen into the street. And if you watch the videos of the crashes, none of them show that happened. They show the plane melting into the building as if it just got absorbed and the building ate the plane. It doesn't happen partly because of Newton's third law. Newton's third law says that to every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. In other words, the force of the building on the plane is the same as the force of the plane on the building. Now, the plane isn't made of 3-inch box girder steel, because if it was, it wouldn't fly. We know that. So it has to be made of light materials. Light materials are not as hard as 3-inch box girder steel. So in a plane crash scenario, the plane is going to come off really bad, and the building doesn't really have that much damage done to it. So, you know, and if you take a 44 Magnum gun and you fire it at a steel girder, which is going to come off worse? You know, is the bullet going to go through the steel girder? No, it isn't. It's going to ricochet off it. You know, you just have to think about that. And the bullet it's denser. It's a lead bullet. It's flying at about 1,000, 1,500 miles an hour. Yet it still doesn't go through the steel girder. So how could have that happened with a Boeing on 9/11? It's just not possible. So that's your starting point. And then people say to me, well, Andrew, you know, what happened to the passengers? What happened to the plane? What about all those phones?
Well, you know, let me stop there for a minute. It is unfair that the burden of proof at this point is on you, let's say, to prove it didn't happen the way they said. I mean, it is a bit unfair because you're expected to come up with every single answer.
Mm.
What happened to the passengers? What happened to, you know, it's like, well, yeah. You could say, I don't know. But it still doesn't mean that the plane brought the building down. You know what I'm saying? There is a burden of proof on the person who opposes the theory, where that first theory doesn't get that same level. It's just kind of accepted, but now you have to climb mountains to go around it. So that is a little unfair.
Exactly, and I think, you know, what that's the result of is the media exposure. You know, when those tapes were played, you know, endlessly for the first 3 weeks or whatever, it was drilled into people's brains, and it arrested your intellectual processes, you know, and that's what happened to me as well. I was just the same as everyone else at that point, and so I still appreciate what it's like to be, you know, in that state where you've had the story programmed into you, basically. You do have to deprogram yourself from it.
So look, this is kind of fascinating to me personally here. So what you're saying is there wasn't a plane that they perhaps had charges set off to make a hole look like a
plane?
No
charges.
No?
No charges. Again, if you go and look at the data Dr. Wood uncovered, you know, I'll always return to that. One of the things that she was looking at was the magnetometer readings. Now, these magnetometers were over in Alaska, and they're managed by Alaska, University of Alaska. And, you know, you can access their website, and you could download these magnetometer traces, right? Now, these measure the Earth's magnetic field as to whether it's trending north or trending south, and it does vary, you know, with these sort of coronal mass ejections and things like that, which affect the Earth's magnetic field. And Dr. Judy Wood went back and got the traces for 9/11, and curiously, the magnetic field becomes severely disrupted throughout the events of 9/11, and then on the next day it kind of settles down again. But specifically, one specific trace she did, and you can see this on her website if you go into the Hurricane Erin series, and I've reproduced it on my website in a couple of places and in YouTube videos and stuff. She has this trace from starting at about 8:26 on 9/11, 8:26 in the morning, and the Earth's magnetic field starts dipping, and it reaches its minimum point at precisely 8:46, at which point it starts to recover. And of course, 8:46 was the time of the supposed first impact. So how can a plane crash influence the Earth's magnetic field as measured 3,500 miles away? This is not possible.
Well, can I, before we go that way, can I stay around the planes for a second? Because So did planes hit the building?
I don't know what hit the buildings.
Okay,
it wasn't a plane. It wasn't a plane. What I do think is that a lot of people who were actually on the site, I'm not talking about the news videos.
Right.
A lot of people who were on the site, I think many of them saw something which looked like a plane.
Okay, now right? The first video didn't there wasn't any first video until after the second.
Correct.
And it came later. So someone might argue that it was made up. But
that has been argued, yeah.
The second video, there was apparently live coverage from many different angles when it happened.
Now that's very interesting when you get into it as well, because there were a couple of analyses that were done. There were two live shots, as my understanding, of the impact. One was from Chopper 7 and one was from Chopper 5. So these were both from choppers. And yet, if you think about the sequence of events of what happened, you have this first crash, and then all the news media went down to ground, you know, to the site of the World Trade Center, Ground Zero, as some people call it, and they were talking to people there, what happened, we heard bombs, we heard explosions going off. But we have no network news footage of the second plane crash from the ground. We have a couple from the air, but none from the ground.
So no network. All the
footage that's taken from the ground is amateur film, which was submitted after the event.
That is a little wild. Unless they were just depending solely on that helicopter, that is kind of wild.
It is. And one of the helicopter pilots, he was, at least one of them, was killed a couple of years ago in a car mounted to pavement, and he was killed. Again, if you watch a film called September Clues, and you look at the video evidence from the events of the plane crashes, you will get some serious eyebrow raising material for you if you're not used to it. You'll beginning to be thinking, well, how deep does this really go? Because the September Clues film does ask a lot of very basic, very simple questions, and comes up with some very unusual answers.
Yeah, I think, you know what? I think I recently obtained that. YouTube or something, writer, and I have not seen it yet. So now I'm going to put that on my top of the list, something to at least listen to. I drive throughout the week, and I stack up all these videos to kind of listen to while I'm driving. So, right, but hold on, we're going to take a break, and we'll come back with the final hour with Andrew Johnson, and he has got a website that can bring out all this information. It's put together well, so you can kind of just follow the bouncing ball, so to speak. And that is checktheevidence.com. And we'll be back live to talk about 9/11 non-demolition energy weapons after this. We have the technology. We're going to do what we want. We're going to get what we want. And we're talking tonight with Andrew Johnson, live from England, who has the website Check the Evidence and is putting together the points for a alternative to the demolition, controlled demolition, which brought down the trade centers and whatnot. And welcome back, Andrew.
Thanks, yeah.
What about if I can hop to Building 7, that looked more like a controlled demolition, classic demolition, though there was no film to show squibs and whatnot. How does that fit in with the energy beam?
Yes, that's a good question, and, you know, again, it's what a lot of people mention to me when they say, oh, well, you know, yeah, we can sort of go with the idea that the 1 and 2 turned to dust, but clearly Building 7 was a controlled demolition, there's no doubt about it. But again, it comes down to how much evidence you begin to study, and the first point I would probably raise is that Building 7 was, I think it was about, I forget how much higher, I think it was about 50 or 60 feet higher than the tallest building that's been destroyed ever with controlled demolition. So that's one minor point to start off with. But the second thing to look at is what actually happened to the building during the day. Now this is quite tricky to establish unless you look at a sequence of pictures. And this is something, again, that Dr. Judy has done, Dr. Judy Wood, on her website. And she actually noticed things like huge lots of fumes only coming out of one side of the building for most of the day, which was very peculiar. And she also noticed other things like the seismic signature was, I think, 0.6. And if you go and look at the seismic scale as to what 0.6 is, it's the same, I think, as a jackhammer hitting the ground. So in other words, the seismic signature appeared to show that the building didn't even hit the ground. So how can that be if you've got this 47-story building coming to the ground? And even, again, if you go and look at NIST's own report, they talk about videos of the tower's destruction, and you could hear the conversations on the videos. In other words, the building coming to the ground was almost completely silent. How is this possible? Because if you imagine that let's just take for a moment that it was controlled demolition, that cuts the steel girders up into sections, and then the building collapses under its own weight. But that's going to be a very noisy process. And again, we don't have the pop 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 bang bang bang. That is not heard on any of the videos, but neither is the actual clanging of all these steel girders and the building contents crashing to the ground, which is also NIST's explanation that the fire literally weakened, I think, one or two of the central supports and the whole building collapsed. If that was true, then you would have heard this enormous clanging and banging. You know, you think of walking along the sidewalk and a big truck goes past you. Right. You know, and you can feel the vibrations as it's coming towards you. And, you know, you might look round and maybe you've got your iPod on and you're not really hearing the sound, but you can feel the vibration going up your leg as it's coming past. And this is just from maybe, what, a 40-ton truck or something? I mean, what's going to happen when you've got all that material coming down to the ground from a...
Well, how
from
far were the video? I mean, because the only pictures I've seen of the collapse are quite far away.
Well, that's true. They weren't all that far away. The nearest one was perhaps, I don't know, 3 blocks. You're going to hear that sort of noise coming down. You know, there were people that were close to it. You know, again, I'd have to go and actually look at the videos and count the blocks, but it's going to be one heck of a lot of noise.
In this case, you have the beam from working from the top down on the further first two, but the last one, it would, I would appear to work from the bottom up, I would guess?
Well, yeah, I mean, certainly the mode of destruction is different, yeah. Absolutely, the buildings seem to disappear from the top down. But again, what Dr. Wood she hasn't really had a chance to discuss this in much detail, because I think as she's looked at the pictures more and more, she actually concludes that the process of destruction wasn't instant. In other words, it's like, you know, if you look at what John Hutchison does again, when he sets this process going, he doesn't like just flick a switch and the metal jellyfies. Typically what he'll have to do is he'll have to leave the thing going for 10, 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, and then the effects start. It's like the environment has got to be almost charged up. And this again seems to be what happened, if you look at the picture sequence carefully, and for Towers 1 and 2, Dr. Judy would map this out in her new Hiroshima presentation, and that's available on the internet.
Oh, that's hers?
Yeah, New Hiroshima, 9/11, the New Hiroshima, that's Dr. Judy's presentation about, and she points out how the World Trade Center towers fumed for about, for quite a long time before the destruction. I think it was possibly as long as an hour. These massive fumes were coming out of the building. It wasn't fire and smoke. It was some other type of process, almost as if the building was being dissolved on the inside. You know, and what we saw on the outside was pretty much unchanged. And then the final part.
Well, that would be interesting. That would be interesting. The inside dissolved and it collapsed.
Yep. And then they just went and did the exterior, and down it all came.
And it would go along with some explosions heard in the basement.
Yep.
By witnesses early in the that's very interesting.
So you know, when you start to look at it in this sort of way, you think, well, this doesn't sound so crazy after all. You look at all these jumpers jumping out. What was happening to them? Why were they jumping out when they were perfectly safe? Well, what if they'd been in the way of this dissolving beam that was dissolving the building inside where we couldn't see it?
That would explain the hole, and it would explain the mass of molten stuff down in the basement.
Well, the molten stuff wasn't actually there. That's another story which was planted.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, there's a picture taken, I think, by, what's his name? I forget the name of this guy, but there's a famous picture with these firemen looking down into a hole, and this is said to be them looking down into molten metal, but actually it isn't. I believe that they've got a flashlight under there, and if they were that close to the molten metal, it would have burned the skin off their faces. You know, you can do the calculation.
Well, that's right. She did mention that. She did mention at the time, I remember having her, that they were way too close to it.
And also, let's also remember that things that are molten aren't always hot. So, you know, we argue from John Hutchison's experiments that he can make metal go molten, and yet when he puts his hands into and picks up the sample a few minutes later, it's cold. It's actually slightly colder than the environment. So, in other words, things that turn molten aren't necessarily hot. So, even if some of these people did see molten glowing metal, it may have become molten and glowing through a different process, through some type of nuclear change. This is what I think was going on, because again, John Hutchison has seen these weird fires in his experiments, and we've even got a video of this, these weird fires in this boat experiment, which I've put onto a DVD and things like that. So everything is there, really, for me. You know, we've mapped out all the main phenomenon, or I should say that Dr. Judy Wood has mapped them out, and I've kind of just made a few YouTube videos on her behalf and stuff like that, and I've got a YouTube channel, and you can go and watch those. You know, ADJ UK is my YouTube channel, and there's all kinds of stuff on that. So, you know, all this stuff is there, and it's really a matter of investing the time in studying it. Which is what I've had to do, you know, and obviously it's taken me twice as long to write up what I've written up, you know, so I've tried to make it as accessible as I can. Then I've got to leave it, you know, I've really got to leave it and say, well, look, you know, it's up to you to come to your own conclusions about this, you know, because if I try and just beat anyone over the head with it, then I'm no different to anyone else, you know, that's trying to sort of push a theory or whatever. You know, if I don't want people to form a group around me or anything, you know, I just want them to think for themselves and come to their own conclusions. And I think they will find that the conclusion that energy weaponry was used fits all of the evidence, not just the the physical evidence, but as I say, people, the connections of people like Stephen E. Jones and several other figures that, you know, I could perhaps mention. So, you know, these phenomena have to be explained, and the alternative is to explain the evidence. So if we're wrong about the Hutchinson effect, and we're wrong about how it actually worked and what it actually affected, then let's have another explanation that explains all the evidence. Let's not have people insulting us and saying that we're whack jobs, which I've had quite a few times, and all this abuse. Let's just have the facts, let's have the evidence, let's have it explained, please, and if you've got the explanation, let's take it to the people who should have explained it, like NIST, or, you know, NIST and their contractors, and hold them accountable for their actions in terms of, you know, actually explaining what went on. They were given, you know, $16 million to explain what happened, and they didn't explain it, and they even said they didn't explain it. So that's fraud on its face, you know. So these are the sorts of things we end up dealing with when we get through this evidence, I think, you know.
Now, let's see, if we go back to 7 for a minute, I know you can't know all the answers and everything, so when I ask questions, that I'm not expecting
an
answer.
Fine. Okay, no, it's fine. Please
why ask you, do you think that perhaps the 7 was included on this? Because I know the demolition people think that it was perhaps that's where they controlled it, and then they had to get rid of the evidence. But I also noticed that there was a huge bankruptcy that was being done, and all the evidence was in there. Did you have any ideas of why 7 went down in this mess?
Well, not really, to be honest with you, James. You know, I think establishing the motive, you know, why didn't they destroy the Bankers Trust building? Well, you know, why did they only destroy the buildings that had a WTC prefix? You know, they were the only ones that were destroyed. You know, if we extend that question, why was 7 destroyed, we can extend it to say, well, why were only the World Trade Center buildings destroyed? You know, it does lead one to the conclusion,
right,
perhaps, that, you know, Larry Silverstein had something to gain from the situation. But then again, as I occasionally mention, I'm not an expert on this. The site was maybe partly, the destruction was maybe an occult ritual of some kind, you know, and then when you get into all that angle, again, going back to the other things that you mentioned, the Enron scandal and the WorldCom, the documents were reportedly held in World Trade Center 7 and lots of CIA files and all this sort of thing. But, you know, we don't actually know. I've seen various. I think there was a list in the Loose Change film of all the offices that were in World Trade Center 7, but we don't actually know what was in those filing cabinets that were turned to dust. You know, for sure, we've heard stories, but again, we don't have photographs of what was actually in there. So I think it's very difficult to establish the motive as why 7 was. And, you know, my question will be, well, why did they wait, you know, whatever it was, 5 hours, 6 hours, 7 hours, whatever it was, to destroy Building 7? Why didn't they just do it, you know, do 1, 2, and then 7 half an hour later or 10 minutes later? Why did they wait that many hours? You know, that's another question, and I'm not sure. I don't have the answer to that question, you know.
Right. Because I'm asking, because a lot of times I have guests on, and they have very well-researched points, but then they have some, well, I don't know what to call it, gut feelings along with the evidence, and that's why sometimes I'll ask you to go over to, just the science side. It's just, you know, because a lot of times you might say something, well, I thought maybe this, and that could all open up another line of reasoning, and you know, you never know what you stumble into when you go like I call it a lateral drift when you're thinking.
I agree,
something.
And I think that's very important in the sort of process of finding the truth. You have to go off at a tangent sometimes and just say something that's completely sounds completely ridiculous, because it can, you know, transfer you onto a new thread, in which you'll discover something very important. And if I may, I sort of discovered that in relation to 9/11 as well, because I found a connection to the way that crop circles are made in, and what happened at the World Trade Center. And I think it's
what
a fairly strong connection.
What is
yeah,
this?
Yeah, I think it's a fairly strong connection as well, actually, because it's based on several points of evidence. Now, and it also involves Steve Nee Jones as well. Now, I don't know whether you heard, but I think it was a couple of years ago, Steve Nee Jones and I think it was Niels Harriot and a couple of other people, they came out with this scientific paper where they said they'd done a study of the 9/11 dust, and in that dust, they discovered iron-rich microspheres. And they actually got some, you know, electron micrographs from an electron microscope in this paper. And you can, you know, if you just put 9/11 microspheres into Google, I think you'll find this paper and you
okay,
can see
Okay, I remember
papers.
That. Yeah, I saw that.
Right, okay.
Right.
And then I've done a talk about crop circles and stuff, and there's a very interesting scientific website about crop circles, and it's called BLT, Bravo Langer, Bravo Lima Tango, BLTResearch.com. And if you go onto there, you'll find a study that they did in 1999 in a crop circle. And in the soil of where that crop circle was, they discovered iron spheres. And those spheres are 10 to 40 microns in diameter, which was exactly the same as that found in the World Trade Center dust. Now, I've got a couple of accounts. One from Pat Delgado, who's a UK crop circle researcher who passed away last year. He was 90 years old. And another one from Colin Andrews, and another one from Freddie Silver, who all have reported being levitated near a crop circle. So we've got two connections. People were reported being levitated during the events of 9/11. And we've got the upside-down cars on 9/11, which seems to be an effect on gravity, which has caused these cars to flip over. So, hang on a minute, we've got also another bit of evidence here, because in the BLT research study that you can go and look at on their website, the scientist who analysed the soil samples says that he's found evidence in the crystalline structure of some of the materials in the soil that it appears to have been heated to between 600 and 800 degrees centigrade. But this is underneath the crop, and the crop is basically just flattened, it's not burned. So you've got evidence of high heat in the soil, but no heat on the crop. And that's exactly what we saw on 9/11, with evidence of high heat on one part of the car, with the paintwork apparently all burned off, and the evidence of no heat 2 feet away with an intact inflated tyre, and, you know, as I say, unburned upholstery. So I made this into a little YouTube video, and people can go and check out the links and find all the evidence for themselves. I think it's the same technology which is being used to make some of the not all of them, some of the crop circles, as was used to destroy the World Trade Center, and it's based on this physics that John Hutchison has discovered. It can affect gravity, it can affect materials, it can change their properties, it probably works at a nuclear level. It's related to cold fusion somehow. It's maybe related to zero-point energy. And I think all the evidence is there, and all you've got to do is put it all together. And I think it's precisely, you know, that process you were talking about, going off at a tangent. That's how I came onto it. You know, I mean, I just studied crop circles because I was interested in it. I never dreamed that I'd find this what I think is a pretty strong connection in aspects of the evidence between that and the World Trade Center, you know. So there you go. You know, I think that shows you that some of these crop circles, to me, have been deliberately created in black operations, and I think in certain circumstances they're being used to inject false information into the New Age movement and sort of trick people into this 2012 scenario that there's going to be this great big cataclysm. And I think that there is some, I'm not saying the Mayan calendar is invalid, but because, you know, there's a lot of historical references to that and whatnot. But I think the meaning of what's going to happen in 2012 is very much open to debate. And I think somebody, some group, has a special interest in trying to persuade people that a certain type of outcome is going to come about. And I think they're using this technology in crop circles, at least in part, to try and do that.
Well, there has been people who have talked about the Project Blue Beam, I think it was, where it holograms are going to be used to make spaceships or Jesus come or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it could be also an alien invasion is another one that they're going to do to kind of get everybody together.
Yeah.
And so the whole 2012 scenario may have been created, by this and fostered by these things. And that's fascinating to hear about the idea that they could sit like at a computer desk and come up with a fractal design, which would be very easy to do on a computer, especially for graphic artists, and then just push a button and have it burn into the ground, you know?
Absolutely, and I think if you look at this aspect of just being able to control gravity, then if you can create a locally heightened gravity field, in other words, you can increase gravity to, as you say, to a fractal design that you've drawn on a computer in some program, then like you say, you can just flick a switch and away you go, and you get your design on the ground maybe in 5 or 10 seconds, which of course is how these crop circles have been reported as appearing by some people. And we do seem to have a common theme with microwave energy as well. Microwave energy does seem to figure in this technology somehow, because that's what John Hutchison uses. We appear to have certain types of heating effect, not exactly the same as what's in a microwave oven, for example, but similar. And again, this is what the BLT study in the crop circles, they talk about microwave heating as well, and the evidence for that. So there seems to be a set of common themes here. And you're not totally just, clutching at straws and getting nothing. You are getting a few straws that you can grab onto and make some sense of,
Yeah.
That's what I've really, that's really what I've been trying to do with, because why I've put that website together is to, get all those threads and see if you can, see the pattern a bit more clearly. It's very, very difficult, but I think some things like this can become a bit clearer once you've scraped around for enough of the evidence,
I just got an email from Tanasi, who's listening, and actually, I don't know if that's a man or woman. So he or she sent some links saying, no way, video fakery all the way, and we didn't catch it at first either, and it sent me a bunch of references, so I'll be combing through that. And at the bottom, you mentioned a great interview, keep on keeping on. So that's good.
Oh, well, good, yeah.
Well, I'm really fascinated by the crop circle thing. That's something I'm going to think about. Maybe I can get back to you on that when I have a crop circle show on it or something, because that I've not been satisfied with the Earth doing it or aliens doing it. I mean, obviously, if we could create a crop circle using the technique you're alluding to, well, obviously aliens can do it. But if we can do it, we don't need to have aliens doing it. And so, and then if it is being done, if it is some kind of a disinfo or a hurting thing, then we can try and look at what are the messages they are claiming, and so we'll look behind it and what's the intended result. So that would be a whole nice show in itself. Well,
sure.
Well, we're going to take a break in a second. Well, we got a half hour left, and I kind of like poking around at some of these, what you're coming up with. So maybe you can, when we come back from the break, think of something you want to go into in the last half hour about this. And also, just for just a couple of seconds here, filler, you got a lot of stuff on the website that's pretty cool. I'd love to talk to you about the moon, about Mars, and all this stuff, too. So that might be fun to work out, too. Because one of the things I have a problem understanding is the alleged Mars jump room that these guys are coming out saying, allegedly, who are insiders, that you can walk through a door and end up on Mars back in the 1960s. And I'm finding it pretty difficult to believe that. I can't say no. I don't know. But those are some of the Mars stories that I've had, too. So maybe that's a time for another time. But you can go to the website and poke around. There's a lot of cool stuff. Definitely interesting. You got some time to kill. You can kill it and learn stuff at the same time. So check theevidence.com. And we'll be back to continue with Andrew after these messages, all live from England.
Live from Chicago, here's the Black Knight of Talk Radio, James Arthur Yancic.
I'm really upset about this oil thing. It is, somebody's thought about using a nuclear bomb to seal the hole. I'm thinking, God almighty. They didn't know there was, allegedly, they didn't know there was that much pressure in there to begin with. And so now, how do we know we don't blow it up? It just goes in one big oil column up into the atmosphere. Now we got raining oil around the whole world. I mean, geez. It's like, you know, and then you hear about the one guy who claimed he could have stopped it in 8 hours, still can do it. And the technique, he was on the news talking about it, and yet BP or the United States won't talk to him. It drives me kind of nutty. But we are talking now with Andrew Johnson. His website, checktheevidence.com. He's talking to us live from England. And welcome back, Andrew.
Hi there.
You might move on to this whole oil thing as time goes on. It might be another little chapter on your website.
Yeah, well, I've been trying to keep up with it. It's obviously, as you said, I've been feeling a bit depressed about it, thinking about all the people on the Gulf Coast, and it's a pretty major ecological disaster already. And you know, I think everyone's wondering how big it's going to get, because it ain't getting any smaller as time goes
no.
by.
And I looked at the picture from space, and it's headed right toward the loop, the Gulf Loop, which will take it right up, you know, right up the East Coast, and then leap across over to England and Spain,
oh, yeah.
Portugal. I mean,
yeah.
it's talk about a nice one shot. You want to really destroy the United States economy and tip time over to Europe. Here's a way to do it.
Well, this is it, and I think what really depresses me, James, to be honest with you, is knowing that this technology that destroyed the World Trade Center is in the possession of somebody. And I really genuinely feel that you could stop that oil in a second with that technology if you applied it in the right way, you know. So where you know, I think the key point in this discussion that people, you know, well, I've come to understand, and I hope that other people will come to understand, is that really we're slaves to this technology, and where our world has been shaped by our lack of access to it. And I think one of the problems here is that, you know, I'm sure you've had guests on talking about this wonderful free energy technology. I know Sterling Allen was on earlier and stuff like this, but which I love to talk about as well and think about. But when I found out that the Hutchinson effect had been turned into this weaponry, you know, I thought, well, the guys that would hopefully release this technology eventually, they're not going to do it, because they've already turned it into a weapon. And that was something of a cathartic moment for me when I realized that happened. And you know, and then we all know about you know, what Tesla discovered, and how really the oil system, if you will, if I can call it that took off just after the time of Tesla. You know, and I think we can all see that Tesla was this, you know, my view is anyway, that Tesla was shut down, and by once he was shut down and out of the way, then they could get this oil system, you know, and the fossil fuel, obviously we know it's an inappropriate name for it now, but they right. could get all that going, you know, once they'd made people forget about Tesla. You know, and then once they'd made people forget about energy medicine, for example, you know, with these violet ray machines, which were based on a Tesla coil, then they could get them popping pills. And so the whole system was in place by about, you know, 1950, late 50s. And that's when we got into this terrible, terrible mess that we're in now, you know. And
yeah, you have Tesla. They not only got Tesla out of the way, they made, I mean, I grew up, I didn't know. Oh, I can't remember when I figured this out. I thought Edison was the one who invented, you know, the AC electricity, the generator. I don't know. And one day I actually just noticed that it was Tesla did all these things, and I'm like, wait a minute, why isn't it? Well, you know, our power company in Chicago area is called Commonwealth Edison. Why isn't it Commonwealth Tesla? You know, and yet he just got, not only did he get, he just got just stepped on in history, just jammed into the ground.
I think, you know, he wanted the truth, and he wanted the best for people. And we find that the people that are running everything don't want either of those things. I think that's the difference. you know, and if you look at what's happened in history, then the meek people like us who just want to, you know, share information and sort of basically be nice to people, we don't really get much of a say in things, you know, because there's this other force that's here, which is really, really calling all the shots, you know.
Right. Well, anyway, I was looking in the break in your webpage. There's a lot of nice videos and audio there. That besides the mentioned video from the New Hiroshima, I saw that Astronauts Gone Wild video. That's kind of
That's kind of embarrassing to watch. Actually, that isn't it? I don't know if you've seen it. Yeah, it's you know, I mean, for me with the moon landing thing, I've got a short video clip posted on there, which is of the 1994 appearance at the White House of by Neil Armstrong. And it's this speech where he says, you know, what we completed was only a beginning. You know, we leave you much that is undone. There are great discoveries to be made and ideas to be, you know, found by those who can remove one of the truth's protective layers. And for him to say this in the presence of President Clinton at the White House on the 25th anniversary of the moon landing, I mean, it's always struck me as an extremely peculiar thing for him to have said. You know, if it was me and I'd walked on the moon and I was this great American hero, I would have said something along the lines of, you know, well, we were privileged to be able to go to the moon, and we had a great team of engineers that designed and built all the, you know, the technology and all this. There's a hundred things like that you could have said, and yet he starts going on about truth's protective layers. I mean, what truth is there to protect, Neil? You know, what are you talking about here? What layer? What are you saying here? It's very cryptic.
Yeah, you see, when I went through this the moon objections. And, I mean, that's probably, you do this in another show, but I mean, I went through this, and just like when I went through the 9/11 and I said, well, you know, there are some things that don't line up. The one, I've seen explanations for why the flag waved and whatnot, but the one thing that I just can't get over is the way that they went through the radiation belt, Van Allen belt, in 1969. And today, they're talking about going to the moon again, and it's going to take another 20 years. Well, it's probably down to, like, 14. I guess it got canceled anyway. I said, we should be able to go to the moon, like, tomorrow, because we did it in 1969. Yeah. You know, and at that time, the Russians were still using steam up in their ships to control levers and whatnot. And I'm thinking, like, you know, they went to the moon that time. And then you have the shuttle who came not even close to it, but was higher than any other flight, and they started to have the radiation problems.
Yep.
And they weren't even, didn't even go through it. I mean, they were just nearer it than anybody else other than Apollo, allegedly.
Well, this is it, and I think it's a very troubling topic for people to think about, because, you know, you automatically assume that what you were told was true. But again, when you start scratching the surface, you get some pretty serious questions like the ones that you're raising, and
you know what? Let me ask you this, though. The main objection I have to them not going, forget the radiation one, is you would think during the middle of the Cold War, the Russians would have jumped up and down screaming, saying that, no, they didn't really go. And here's our proof. They just went around the Earth while this happened and then came down.
Well, that's a very interesting point, and it's one which I've talked about, actually, because there is another part of one of the videos about the moon landings by David Percy, in which he highlights this story about Yuri Gagarin. Now, and I was already partly familiar with this story because I saw a BBC documentary in about 1999, and in that documentary it was revealed that Yuri Gagarin didn't land in his capsule. In this BBC documentary, it revealed for the first time that he actually parachuted, or he was said to have parachuted out of his capsule, and he landed away from it. And I was thinking, oh, that's a bit odd. I mean, you know, and you think of the logistics of that. You know, you're coming in through the atmosphere with things air rushing past you at whatever 1,000 miles an hour.
Very fast.
Yeah, you know. And you have to yank the hatch open of this clunky craft thing and then jump out of the side of it. I mean, you're already thinking, oh, that's a bit strange. And then they talk about this story that it was 61 when Gagarin went up, and in that year there was some questioning when the story was published that Gagarin had actually gone up. And David Percy's film talks about this discovery of this footage of Gagarin in his spacesuit, and he was sitting apparently in the capsule, yet he has two shadows behind him. In other words, there was a lighting in front of him, and there was no room for that lighting in the capsule. So he points out that this film must have been pre-shot as some type of, you know, publicity and propaganda shot. And then he relates the story of Korolev, who was the launch controller, stopping the countdown, saying that there was a problem with the hatch on the capsule that Gagarin was in, and the gantry was moved back, and the bolts were adjusted by a team of four people, and then they said, "Oh, we've got it all sorted out," and the countdown resumed. And so I think what actually happened then is that Gagarin was taken out of the capsule. He was put into a plane. They flew to the place roughly where the capsule was going to come down, or wherever it was, somewhere near there, and he parachuted out of the plane because they couldn't afford for that mission to go wrong.
So, in essence, it's going to be you telling us, we telling you.
Exactly.
Oh, God.
So it's the whole, it's this whole issue of playing the Ruskies off against, I mean, they started the whole, you know, space race with that. And they got generated millions of dollars for themselves, and they got people into it, you know. We were really, I mean, I grew up on that stuff. You know, I grew up on the Apollo landings. I was into it. I wanted to be an astronaut when I was 5 years old, you know. And, you know, so look at the psychological capital they got out of that whole thing, you know. And now where are we? The shuttle is just about on its last flight with no replacement in sight that does anything like it. You know, technology goes backwards in manned space flight, but in every other area it goes forwards.
So what do you think what do you think we're doing up in the space station?
Don't know.
I mean, I have no idea what they're doing. I mean, they could be playing cards for all I know. I mean, talk about doing tests and whatnot. I don't know if they're just biding time or if there's some hidden technology up there. Or?
Yeah. Well, I think it's just purely for academic interest. I mean, I think all the technology that the people that run the planet want, they've already got. You know, I think if you look at the evidence for the secret space program, such as the TR-3B, I think there's some pretty good evidence that exists. We've got videos, we've got some whistleblower testimony which seems to tie up with some of the videos. I'm thinking of a chap called Edgar Fouché, who very few people seem to speak of, and he seems to have disappeared now. But I think there is a secret space program, and I think it's much more advanced than most people, you know, realize. And I think that all factors into this Apollo, you know, cover-up, basically. So, again, it becomes more difficult to...
Well, so that would mean they'd have to have an advanced space program that they did after the Apollo mission, because they weren't able to do Apollo, but then something happened and they skyrocketed forward then.
Well, I think it's been, you know, I mean, if you look at what happened, but if you look at Nick Cook's book, The Hunt for Zero Point, for example, and he talks about how all the major aircraft companies were doing serious anti-gravity research, and I've got some documents from Douglas Aircraft, which proves that they were doing anti-gravity research or something related to that in the 60s. But he said most of it was shut down in the 1950s. The really serious stuff was shut down in about 1956. All the major aircraft companies were doing research into anti-gravity technology, and it was shut down in around that time. So if you think that was sort of, you know, just before Sputnik, wasn't it? Because Sputnik was 57. So, again, it seems that plans were being made.
Well, the entire space program would have been there just to keep us busy. Meanwhile, they are already farther advanced than that at that time.
I think God. So. And going back to the Mars...
You know...
I think it does, and going back to the Mars thing that you mentioned, a lot of this I think is just disinformation, because, you know, the Mars, going into a chair and going to Mars, it could be true. You know, I don't know. I haven't got any evidence to disprove that story is true. It could well be true. And if you look at some of the physics which is opened up by this Hutchison effect, maybe there is such a teleportation device or a portal or a time portal that you can walk into and come out. You know, I just don't know. I certainly wouldn't say it's impossible. What I would say is that some of the people who have been promoting that story, and I'm thinking particularly of a chap called Alfred Weber, who threatened me with libel for publishing an article which purely contains what he actually said and links to audio recordings of him saying it, which was in relation to his discussion about how the World Trade Center was destroyed. He and this fellow called Andrew Basiago, they were promoting this story about the chair, the jump room to Mars, and I think there was a couple, it wasn't just them, there was somebody else involved as well. And so I became very suspicious of this story because of their pedigree and how they'd reacted to some of the verifiable evidence about the destruction of the World Trade Center, which had already been posted, and they basically tried to debunk that and say that HAARP, or Alfred Weber did, and another character called Loren Murray, they basically said that HAARP destroyed the World Trade Center. It couldn't have been anything else, and they don't even mention Dr. Wood's name in this discussion of the evidence, and that's all in this book that I wrote as well, and all the audio links are on the website, so you can actually hear them saying what I say they're saying. And this guy claims to be a lawyer, but yet he doesn't seem to realise that he can't sue me for libel because all I'm reporting is what he actually said. You know, so it's all very strange and peculiar to me. Well, actually, it's not when I'm, you know, from my perspective, but,
right.
But if you look at it from the outside, maybe it does seem a bit weird and it puts people off, so I think that's what it's designed to do, you know. But there is definitely a connection between Mars and the Earth as I see things. That's a whole other interesting story that I'm sure you've had other guests talk about more knowledgeably than I could.
Actually, I'm going to have Sir Charles Schulz on in a couple of weeks talking about
it.
He's got a book out. He's been on a couple of times. I tell you, when I looked at his evidence for the fossils, it's like, wow. I mean, it's pretty open and shut. And then the whole deal about making the sky different color. So then I wonder what they're doing up there at all, you know, because it sounds like they're buffaloing us at one end, hovering up evidence on another end. So what are they doing? Again, I don't know. It's so aggravating.
Absolutely. I mean, to me, I call it perception management. What they've got to do is they know that, you know, a lot of people are finding stuff out now, and they're starting to go, there's actually more to life than I realized, and it looks like, looks like I'm being manipulated. I don't really like this. I thought I was intellectually free, and I lived in a democratic society, and actually, no, I don't. What am I going to do about it? And a lot of these people, you know, are waking up to this and getting rather angry. And to me, it's actually, to me, I look at it as a war on consciousness. You know, I look at it more from the higher realms, that you've got these people trying to drag us down into the lower realms and keep us there. And we, the cattle, are now sort of, we've seen the fence around the field, and we're starting to sort of push up against it and finding it's a bit bendy, and we might be able to break through it. And we go out into these new fields, which we'd like to explore. You know, and I think that's what the cattle herders are getting a bit worried about right now, and they're having to sort of come up with all these fear cards to prod us back into the field and say, no, you're not going to go outside there, you're not going to go and look at those interesting things over there. You know, they're really not for you.
Yeah, but these people, I mean, they're like dumping gazillion gallons of oil in the water. I mean, it's not good for them either. I mean, you know, I don't.
Well,
I
mean, that's the puzzle, isn't it? But are they like us? You know, how much do they need the physical environment that our physical bodies need, or are they operating on a more fear-based level?
That brings up to a question in the chat room. We're almost out of time, but do you have any short words on the Anunnaki, be it Sitchin's or even the David Icke variety?
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at that, and it's very interesting. Again, it's harder to put, you know, to sort of pin down, because you haven't got, you're working with ancient texts and stuff like that. But again, if you looked at the Star Child Skull, which is, I don't know if you had Lloyd Pyon as a guest, is getting some pretty, and he's recently had some new tests done. You know, I don't know if you knew that, they've managed to recover from nuclear DNA from the Star Child Skull now. Gigantic. Yeah, yeah, that's just literally a couple of months ago. They've recovered a little bit now, and the sequences that they've so far, got don't match anything on Earth.
So, well, we reached that point of the show, and 3 hours zipped by, and I knew it would, and I appreciate you not only staying up and being live, but in the greater context, your work, putting up your website, which people can easily go to and download at checktheevidence.com, Andrew Johnson. I appreciate coming here, and keep us abreast if you find some new and something comes up. I can always have it on for a moment, or even tape a little segment or something just to get the information out. So keep us in mind if you come up with some interesting stuff.
Fantastic. Yes, I will. Thanks very much.
Alrighty. And you can go to the website and spend a lot of time. There already is plenty of interesting stuff on there. That's an interesting word, stuff is. So remind me, I'm going to leave the webcam picture up with my own little version of the blue laser that supposedly started the oil fire. You can see that it is a lens option. But that does not mean there is not a lot of weird stuff out there that is being used to control and manipulate us. Direct energy weapons can not only bring down the Detroit Towers, but they can do also a lot of stuff and get our heads to think things or feel things. I don't know. I'm antsy. I feel something's going to happen. I don't necessarily mean it's good, but there's something going to happen. And so I guess it's time to get your head together and get your spirit together and go into this time of unknown tumultuousness, with a peace that you can only come from inside. We'll see you next week live. Reach for the skies within.
Fire is a production of IPS Media Works on the OnSIG Radio Network of Stations.